Call to order the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. Welcome to everyone. Hope you had lunch so we can pay attention. I'd like to welcome today, well, first, before we get to our presenters, I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting, January 20th.
Mr. Chairman, I take the motion to move.
Okay, Representative Benson moves the minutes. Any corrections? Not all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are approved. Get the hard stuff out of the way. We'd like to welcome the private higher education members of our state, providers in our state, to our hearing today. And I'm not sure who will begin, but please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Pripino, the president of Augsburg College and the chair of the Minnesota Private College Council at the moment. And I'm joined by my colleagues, Dr. Marianne Beniger, who is the president of the College of St. Benedict, and by Mr. Paul Cirkvenik, who is the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. And it's a great privilege to be with you today. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to share information about Minnesota's private colleges. I'd like to begin by thanking members of the committee, members of the House, and for the power that the state grant program plays in the lives of our students. I think that, as you'll have a chance to hear over the next few minutes, the opportunities that our students have to pursue higher education in our state made possible from the generous support of the state grant program is something that's fundamental to our commitment to access and excellence in education. We know that times are tough. These are difficult budget times, and that tough choices will have to be made, and we very much look forward to our work together, but we also want you to know just what a difference that program has made for our colleges and for our students in particular, and the impact it's had on our state. So I thank you for your service, and thank you for the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. We're going to proceed in three broad sections. I'm going to ask Mr. Cirkvenik to begin by sharing with you some information about the private sector in higher education in our state. As you know, we may know we have 17 members of our association across the state. Then I and Dr. Beniger will actually share a little glimpses into the lives of our own institutions, just as a case study, if you will, or an examples of where we are living out our missions and helping to really help to make our state a better place. And then we will focus in our third section then on the impact of the state grant program for our students. So with that, unless there are questions, I would ask that Mr. Cirkvenik begin our presentation.
Okay. Again, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cirkvenik, president of the Minnesota Private College Council. The Private College Council is an association of 17 private, nonprofit, four-year colleges and universities. Our schools have a long history of serving the state and its residents. In fact, two of our colleges, Hamline University and St. John's University, were founded before the state itself was admitted to the Union. Today, our schools serve about 60,000 students. Of those, 45,000 are undergraduate students, and those undergraduate students receive a liberal arts education at our schools. The liberal arts education is one of the hallmarks of our 17 schools. About 15,000 of our students are students in graduate level programs. 11 of our 17 institutions have graduate programs. As you can see from the chart, overall the private colleges educate roughly the same share of Minnesota students as do the University of Minnesota and the Minsky four-year universities. Private college schools produce about 30% of the bachelor's degrees granted annually in the state. Importantly, we produce a larger share of degrees in some of the fields most critical to the state's economic success, including 50% of the physical science degrees, 46% of the math and statistics degrees, 40% of health professions degrees, 36% of degrees in foreign languages and biology, and 34% of the degrees in business. At the master's level, we produce about 45% of all master's degrees granted in the state. With respect to master's degrees from our institutions, the leading fields are education, health, business, and public administration. Our colleges are student-focused. They are committed to providing a meaningful and regular interaction between students and faculty. 58% of our classes have fewer than 20 students. That's possible because our schools keep the ratio of students to faculty low, on average 12 to 1. A focus on students translates into solid outcomes. The average four-year graduation rate for full-time, first-time students at our colleges is 64%. That four-year graduation rate is the highest in the state. It's also higher than the national average for private nonprofit colleges, which is 52%. And it's higher than some of the states we would compare ourselves to and be in competition with, including states that, like Minnesota, have very strong private college sectors within their state. The national data comparison, I think, demonstrates the high quality of the private colleges located here in Minnesota. Our colleges provide opportunities for students from all economic backgrounds. One out of four of our students are from families with incomes below $50,000. That's just about the same as at the University of Minnesota and at other public four-year institutions in the state. Another measure of access is the share of students who come from families that do not have a strong college attendance history. One out of five of our students are first-generation scholars, meaning that the highest education their parents completed was high school. The key to keeping our colleges accessible is financial aid. 92% of our students receive financial aid and scholarships that does not have to be paid back. An important part of that 92% is aid from the state grant program and from the federal Pell Grant program. But significantly, $340 million of financial aid is awarded in private grants and scholarships by our institutions. That's money that our institutions raise from their donors and their philanthropic supporters, and that's about 10 times the amount of financial aid that the state grant programs provides to students at private colleges. As a result of all of these sources of financial aid, the average tuition at our schools, the amount that students and their families actually pay for tuition and fees, was about 51% of the published price last year. Now, this chart shows in greater detail the economic distribution of families at our institutions and at the public sector four-year institutions in Minnesota. And as you can see, the economic backgrounds of students at our schools is more or less the same as at the public institutions. Our schools are also committed to providing access to students of color. The orange line on this chart shows the growth over the last decade in the ethnic and racial diversity of our incoming students. In this academic year, about 18% of new freshmen and incoming transfer students are students of color. Our schools provide broad and enriching learning opportunities outside the normal classroom experiences. When we survey our alums, about 9 in 10 say they gain valuable real-world experience while in college through internships, undergraduate research projects, service learning programs, and study abroad opportunities. These kinds of experiential learning opportunities are an important part of the value in an education at our schools. In fact, about a month from now, on February 28th, we will hold our annual Private College Scholars at the Capitol program, where you will have the opportunity to see firsthand examples of undergraduate research projects at our schools. 37 undergraduates from our colleges will be in the rotunda with poster boards documenting their research. They'll be eager to talk to you and to staff and to visitors about their research projects, and they will represent a really wide range of academic disciplines, including biology, English, computer science, American Indian Studies, and nursing. We'll send you a reminder as that day nears, but I hope some of you will have time during the day to stop in at the rotunda and visit with these students.
Can you just repeat the date again?
It's Monday, February 28th. Another of the hallmarks of our colleges is the many study abroad opportunities they offer, which allow more than 4,000 of our students to study abroad each year. In fact, 7 of our colleges are ranked nationally for their share of students studying abroad, and our schools are the source of about 60% of all Minnesota undergrads who study abroad. Finally, I want to touch on the economic impact of our schools in the state of Minnesota. First, we make a critical contribution to the workforce. 76% of our recent grads are staying here, working, and contributing to our economy. Another way to think about our contributions is to look at how many of our students continue their educations beyond a bachelor's degree. About 1/4 of our alums pursue graduate level education upon graduation. We are, in fact, an important source of graduate students at the University of Minnesota. Our undergrads represent about 1 out of every 8 graduate students at the University of Minnesota. And when you look at national data and consider all the undergrads who earn bachelor's degrees in Minnesota and then go on to earn doctorate degrees, here's an interesting fact. About 1/2 of those students earn their baccalaureate degrees from one of our institutions. Finally, our colleges and universities are significant business entities in our state. Collectively, our institutions put about $1.2 billion into the Minnesota economy each year through their operating and capital spending. And our employee count, when combined, would make Minnesota private nonprofit colleges the 11th largest employer in the state of Minnesota. Our colleges offer Minnesota students academic excellence. They have an enrollment that reflects Minnesota, they link students with the world, and they they produce graduates with broad knowledge, critical thinking skills, and lifelong learning ability, the essential tools for economic success in this global economy.
Thank you. Any members with questions? Representative Morrow?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I probably at least ought to ask a question or give a compliment or something, ask for a raise maybe. Thank you very much for your presentation. You know, we're at Gustavus. I'm watching across the way as a new building is being built. And I don't think there's much, if any, state money in that building. Could you comment a little bit about not only the grants and scholarships that the private colleges offer to students, but there's also other investment in educational facilities across the state?
Who chooses to answer?
Mr. Right. Paul Pribenow, the president of Augsburg. Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, the philanthropic support that we receive from alumni, from corporations, from foundations, from other sources in the government have been a major part of what our colleges have been able to count on, both to provide aid to our students, but also to build the infrastructure that provides them the kind of experience that we know that we believe is at the core of the kind of education we offer. So if you go to any of the 17 of our campuses, you will see facilities, whether it's a new science building, a new academic building, a new student center, opportunities really to give them, for most of us, a residential experience, but also an experience of really the high quality of laboratories, classrooms that we believe that they deserve as part of, and you're certainly right, that support for that has come primarily for our private colleges from alumni, to be quite honest. So graduates of our colleges who give back in their various ways, but also from corporations and foundations that see the value of what we do and are willing to be generous in that regard.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm counting the number of members of the Private College Council. I've counted them, but why don't you just tell me, how many are there
17.
Again? There are 17. If we were to compare the administrative overhead of those 17 institutions with MinSCU, how would they compare? Would you know? I don't see it in your graphs, but it's a question that, considering the fiscal plight we're in, I'm very interested in overhead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, we don't have statistics that could answer that question for you. I certainly would invite our presidents to talk about administration on their campuses, though.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I certainly I would agree with you that, in fact, when you have 17 individual institutions, you are going to have an overhead that goes with that that doesn't benefit from the synergies that you get when you have a full system. On the other hand, I would certainly say that all of us are very aware of that issue, and I think that you would find, if you went to individual institutions, many ways in which they are both streamlining administration, looking for partnerships, which of course we get from our participation in the Minnesota Private College Council. I will talk in a few minutes about some of the things that we're doing at Augsburg, that are ways that we are trying to undo some of the redundancies that we get by entering into partnerships with other organizations. So very mindful of the fact, first of all, of course, that our students need the kind of support that that infrastructure provides for them, because we are a separate institution, but at the same time mindful of the fact that we have to be accountable for the fact that it's their tuition dollars and the philanthropic support that we receive that is allowing us to offer them this experience, so we are accountable to them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pilowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. What I'm getting at is this. Is there an overarching administration to those 17 campuses on top of the administration that you have at the campus level?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pilowski, there is not.
Mr. Chair, and again, I'll ask it this way. So almost all of your administration is at the campus level, and you don't find the need for a larger, overarching hundreds of administrators to coordinate the activities of those 17 campuses?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, we do not.
Mr. Chair, and I find that intriguing, given that in the public sector, we seem to have two levels of administration. This isn't pointed at you, but it's just a general observation, that we have one level, which I would suspect is approximately equal to yours at the campus level, and then we have the need for yet another level of literally hundreds of people that have to coordinate those activities. And given the economic pressures that we're under, I would hope that this committee would take a close look at the example of the private colleges, and maybe we should emulate that in the public sector, particularly the MNSCU administrative overhead, just as an observation.
Thank you, Representative Pilowski.
Chair.
Okay, I'm Representative, what was your name again? Rukavina?
Whatever you want it to be, Mr. Chair. You know, perhaps we should tell the Board of Trustees about Mr. Sirk Benick, because evidently his leadership, you know, is synonymous with money saving. But and they're looking for a new chancellor. So, you know. But anyway, Representative Pilowski, I understand what you're saying. I know your concern with the spending at the central office. I have tried to address that. To compare the private colleges and their 17-member board to the MNSCU system, though, is not a fair comparison. There are small colleges like Granite Falls and two-year institutions like Rainy River that don't have an administrative person or other people that a Winona might have and be able to afford. So there are some instances where, having a central office doing things, whether it's legal advice or whatever, does make sense. But I do share your concern on many different levels of administration where there are those people on bigger campuses that do a similar type job. So,
Representative Pilowski.
Mr. Chair, and while we're extolling the virtues of Mr. Sirk Benick, and we're fond of telling how these individuals have located us in sometimes very difficult situations, I was playing golf one summer on a very hot day, and Mr. Sirk Benick managed to find me on that golf course and stay with me for 18 holes. I just thought I'd let you know that his quest for working with us even goes to playing 18 holes on a very hot summer day on a golf course he had difficulty locating.
Just keeping track of your golf score, probably. Representative Bannion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on this. I'm a product of the Claremont College's private school, which has six individual campuses contiguous to each other and shares some back office function. Now St. Benedict, St. John's share some functions that work between them, but that would you characterize that as largely a function of how close you are physically to the other campus? Is that where most of that benefits from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, College of St. Benedict and St. John's University actually operate in an overlapping system, much like a Venn diagram, where we do share certain administrators. We can do that because we're close, we're 4 miles apart, but we don't do that for that reason. We do that because what we can do is preserve the history and culture of the two institutions and the focus on gender. But at the same time, we can double the expertise of our faculty, if you will. So a typical institution that is structured in the traditional way may have a very small faculty of, say, six in the political science department, whereas College of St. Benedict and St. John's University have 12, and those 12 can represent different specialties. So it's a model of higher education that, in fact, is like the Claremont colleges. And they're the only other, Claremont does it, of course, with, I think, six campuses. But College of St. Benedict and St. John's University are structured effectively the same way. Thank you.
Representative Banning.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just making the point, I have a lot of sympathy for Representative Pawlowski's point that sometimes economies of scale get to be diseconomies of scale. When you get to a certain level, and I think one of the things that I find interesting about my friends over in St. Joseph and Collegeville is that they're able to make some parts work, but you still manage to keep your. Do I understand your business offices function separately, or do they function together?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan. They function separately. We're separate corporations.
Right. So you don't have as nearly as much integration there as the Claremont. Claremont has their business office all under one roof. So that's why it's a different level of integration. So it's not. I think he's right. It's not. It's a much different model that's being used here. I just think that we ought to look at, and I'm going to echo your point, Representative Pawlowski, that there's some recognition of a point where economies of scale become diseconomies when you grow too large and try to control too many campuses at one time.
All right, we need to continue with the presentation if there are no more questions at this time.
Mr. Chairman, we'd like the two presidents to each talk a little bit about their particular campuses, but I want to note for the members that we provided you a little booklet with a brief bit of information about all 17 of our member colleges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Priveno, the president of Augsburg College, and as you've heard, there are 17 of us that belong to this coalition, this collaboration that we have through the Minnesota Private College Council, and each of us is in our own rights a very different place. And so I'm pleased to say just a few words about Augsburg College. You have on the screen here our mission statement. Augsburg College educates students to be informed citizens, thoughtful stewards, critical thinkers, and responsible leaders. We think that's our kind of highest calling, that we are, in all of the experiences that we offer our students, really aimed at those outcomes, and we are very much outcome-focused. That is, how do we ensure that through the classes that we offer, the experiences our students have on and off campus, that they are living into those important roles for our state, for our country, and for our world. As you may know, Augsburg College was founded almost 142 years ago. We actually founded in Wisconsin and made the wise move to move here to Minnesota after 2 years. We have been in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood in Minneapolis since 1872. We have approximately 4,200 students, three different types of populations. We have about 2,000 traditional undergraduate students, 1,100 of whom live on our campus. We have about 1,200 students who are adults pursuing undergraduate degrees on the weekends and in Rochester, where we have 400 students. And then we also have about 900 graduate students in six master's programs and in one doctoral program. So you get some sense of a college that's expanded over the past, especially the past 30 years, in response to different markets. What I want to focus, though, on for Augsburg's a glimpse into Augsburg's life are three things that are really dear to our hearts in terms of our focus in both recruiting students, in retaining students, and offering the kind of experience that we do. First is that our college, as you know, is located, as I mentioned, in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, which is, you may not know this, the most diverse zip code between Chicago and Los Angeles. All of our neighbors are Somali and Ethiopian. And in the midst of that, our college has, over especially the past 10 years, made a very specific focus as part of its recruitment to reach out, in particular into the city, the metro high schools, to recruit students of diverse backgrounds. And we're very proud that over the past 2 years, 40% of the incoming students into Augsburg College have been students of color, students who are African American, students who are Asian American, Latino Americans, Native Americans, and that's been a huge focal point for our efforts. And what it's really allowing us to do is to create an educational community that has the kind of diversity that our city has, and it allows us to really develop an educational experience and that's shaped by those diverse perspectives in the classroom, on campus, in the residence halls, and out in the community. One of the other parts of that diversity is that 43% of our entering students over the past 2 years were students of the first generation. That is, as Paul mentioned, a big focus point for us, students who did not have parents who graduated any level higher than high school. So these are students coming to us without a support network necessarily to provide, as many of us might have experienced, to provide that understanding of college and how you navigate college. So a big focus point then is how we keep those students in college, how we help them to be successful. And we're very proud over the past couple of years of we've had about an 81% retention rate of those students in college, which is a very significant number compared to industry averages on being able to really focus on helping them to be successful and to achieve the graduation rates that you see that are indicative of our private colleges. So diversity is important, and we think that's particularly important for those of us who are located here in the metro area. When I go to visit the HR offices at Target and at Cargill, we're the kind of institution they're looking to because they know that we are preparing the next generation of employees for their companies, and the fact that we are preparing a diverse population for them is something that's really fundamental to their commitments. And so we're finding a lot of synergy there between our student populations and the employment needs of our state in the years to come. A second focus that I would like to lift up, which kind of goes to a couple of the comments that were made here, we have focused our efforts, and many of our sister institutions in the private colleges have a similar commitment to forming alliances and partnerships that help us to not have to do everything ourselves, and not build redundancies, if you will, between organizations. Three things that I would point to particularly. One is that we have been very active, proactive in our relationships to the MNSCU, especially to the community colleges. I would lift up two particular examples, both the Minneapolis Technical and Community College, MCTC, and Rochester Community and Technical College, RCTC, are places where we have deep partnerships. In fact, this spring we will be teaching Augsburg College courses on the MCTC campus as an example of how we reach into their campus, offer courses that will allow their students to imagine a pathway to not only the associate's degree that they'll receive at MCTC, but then to go forward, especially in areas like nursing and other kind of health professions, to finish their baccalaureate degrees at Augsburg. So this kind of co-branding, this kind of collaboration in a very deep way is something that we're very proud of and that we think is something that's very important as our community colleges grow, that we can reach in and help them to offer their students this pathway to a full bachelor's degree. We also would want to lift up the work of the Associated Colleges of the Twin Cities, very much like the Claremont schools, like the St. John's, St. Ben's partnership. These are the five urban private colleges, Hamline, St. Kate's, St. Thomas, McAllister, and Augsburg, that have for over 35 years been in a partnership that is both an academic partnership and an administrative partnership. So you may not know this, but if you happen to see our buses on the street, we have complete cross-registration across those five colleges. Any student at any of our colleges can take courses at one of the other colleges without any additional cost, and we, in fact, provide the transportation. That's a way that we honor the fact that, just as Marianne mentioned, that we have strengths in particular areas that we can share with each other. But we're also very proud of the fact that this is an administrative partnership, and the five of us do joint purchasing in all the kind of major areas. Last year, together, we saved $2 million for our budgets as a result of our joint purchasing. We've also entered into an associates program where most of the other members of the Private College Council are associates in that purchasing program, so we've reached out and are offering those same savings then to our sister institutions around the state. And then finally, I might just mention the work of Admission Possible. Sometimes some of you may know an organization that helps to prepare high school students, especially those who are first generation or students of color, to go to college. We have a deep partnership with them here in the cities, in the city high schools. and in fact last year started a pilot program where we now have admission possible staff on our campus helping us with our retention efforts with those students who came to us through the admission possible program. So again, another example of where we're sharing staff, we're sharing resources, we're sharing some of these backroom operations as a way of responding to our responsibility and accountability to use our resources wisely. And finally, I would just mention a focus that many of us have. You hear this word, this concept of liberal arts, and I know that Dr. Benninger is going to talk a bit about that, but you know, one time, sometimes people have the stereotype that that isn't practical. I would make the case, and I think all of us would make the case, that in fact it may be the most practical education that our students could ever receive. It helps them to prepare them for the life in the 21st century and the kind of world that we live. But one of the reasons it can be practical is because all of us also understand that classroom learning grounded in the liberal arts needs to be brought together with experiential opportunities for our students. And so we're very proud of the fact at Augsburg that more than 70% of our students participate in internships and work learning experiences out in the cities and in the surrounding areas. Some of them are here in this building, so that they are prepared for when they graduate to step into the workplace, not just with classroom learning, but with that synergy that they receive between their classes and this practical experience. So just a little bit about Augsburg as an example of some of the themes that Mr. Sigvenek lifted up.
We have a question from Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. President. Thank you for your presentation, and I am very impressed with the retention of the students overall and certainly the students of color. And I was just curious a little bit more, not so much about the admissions possible, but other retention strategies you're using, and if you have any upward bound or other kinds of, and do you get state or federal funding for specifically for that? And I'll just tell you that I'm a college counselor at a two-year community college, and so I'm always interested in knowing what kind of your student to counselor ratio might be as well, and how you're helping to guide students and help them to transfer as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, thank you. Certainly the Admission Possible is simply one of the models that we have in place. We are also, many of us are schools that benefit from the Wallen Scholar Program and some of the other programs, AVID, you may know some of these programs. We do have a TRIO program, upward bound program that's quite significant, and we have a McNair Scholars Program that we share. Many of our sister institutions have a program that's preparing students of colors to go on to graduate and professional studies. I would just characterize that I think all of that, those models, what they teach us is that with especially students from first generation families, students from communities of color, that the type of model that works in helping them to be successful is one that we would call intrusive advising. That is where you can no longer take for granted that they're going to understand how to navigate college on their own because they don't know the rules, and many of those rules are unwritten. And so what that has led us to do is to invest in making sure that we are with them, accompanying them, helping them to understand where those rules may be unwritten, where that we can help them to be successful. And what we find is that without a huge amount of effort, once we do that and they build that support network within the college, they then can navigate their way to success. And so it really is offering them that leg up, if you will, to be successful. And that's the model that we've learned from TRIO, that we've learned from Admission Possible, that actually we're now applying across our entire student population.
And just as a follow-up, do you have counselors on staff? Do you have the intrusive advisors? Who are those people?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, we have, let me count the ways. at the moment, I believe that we have approximately between 18 and 20 FDE staff positions that are devoted in some fashion to our retention work. So those would be people in our TRIO program. They would be people in our academic advising. We have an academic skills office. We have multi-ethnic population staff people who play a role in that regard. So it's a very large cohort. It's an important investment on our part to help these students be successful.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been a question that's come up almost every time we've had someone come speak before us, and that has to do with remediation. And could you tell us what percent of students that come to all of your institutions do you have to provide remediation for?
Who'd like to answer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, our institutions vary dramatically on that dimension. Our 17 institutions serve different populations of students, academically, socially, culturally, economically. And so consequently, you will find dramatic ranges in remediation, which I think is a clear benefit of the sector, because it allows institutions to focus primarily on what their population needs. My institution, for example, does very little remediation, comparatively speaking. Our students come in, and of course they need work in math, and they need work in English and literature and writing, but they do that generally at a level that allows us to do that in the context of the regular classroom. I think that Augsburg might have a different profile.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, we would have a very different profile. On the other hand, we do have very strict standards for admission. That means that a student might be identified as a probationary admit, which would mean we might surround them with certain of the resources that I've mentioned, writing labs, the kinds of things. But the fact is, it still takes, you have to reach a certain threshold to be admitted. We have actually started a program I might mention, which after the university closed the General College several years ago, many of us were concerned about those students that might fall through the cracks as a result of that. Augsburg entered into a partnership with one of our other members, St. Kate's, to form an academy program where students who actually are not eligible to be admitted but we think have potential are admitted into this program, which is housed at the old St. Mary's campus across the street from Augsburg near the Fairview complex. And it's St. Kate's and Augsburg together offering them a year of preparation work that then allows them, if they're successful, they then can matriculate to Augsburg as a student after that. And that's been one of the ways we've responded, knowing that those students may not be ready for the full college experience, but also understanding that they have the potential, and figuring out ways that we can bring our resources to bear on helping them to be admitted to college and to take advantage of the experience that we own.
Representative Norton has a follow-up question.
Well, just a statement. I mean, I think sometimes we see these great the great data that you have here, and I just want to acknowledge what you and repeat what you just said, which is you have a higher level, perhaps at the onset, although I'm very impressed with some of the programs that you have to try to perhaps diversify your student population and provide opportunity to others. I respect that, but that sometimes the outcomes are reflective of the student population, and often we see folks try to do comparisons, and so I really appreciated your honesty with that. Thank you.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm looking through your booklet, and I noticed that three of the schools, St. Mary's, Hamline, and St. Thomas, have extremely large graduate populations of full-time and part-time, close to 4,000, actually, in each one, and yet are rather modest undergraduate institutions. Can you explain why those three would have such large graduate populations? I know two of them are metropolitan, but one is not. St. Mary's is based in Winona, so can you explain how they sustain such large graduate populations on such a small undergraduate base?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I won't speak in any great depth on my colleagues' work. St. Mary's graduate program is actually based in the Twin Cities, so
yes,
that does a lot. They're actually down in Minneapolis, in the Phillips neighborhood. I think, as all of us have found who are in the urban areas in particular, responding to the market needs, believing that there's something about a small college, private college experience that can be translated into a particular kind of graduate experience, and then seeing the need for that. So Hamline, for example, with its law school, with its strong education programs, areas of excellence that they believed were important to respond to. It does help them to build a diverse revenue portfolio, if you will, that also then allows them to keep their undergraduate program at the level that it is. You heard our story. It's the same thing. We are not intending to grow our traditional undergraduate population, and we can do that because we have the other programs that surround it.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the answer, because I think if we'd looked at these numbers 20 years ago, can you tell me what we would have seen in that graduate population?
Mr. Chair, Representative, zero, I think, in most cases.
Mr. Chair, and that is one of the really intriguing observations of what the private colleges have done to respond to an economic demand. They've reached out and they said, we will give it to you. And it's impressive. It's very impressive.
Representative Detmer?
Yes, Dr. Prebenow, could you talk about your off-campus master's programs where you go out in the communities and present your master's programs?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. Yes, we have We have a small campus, 20 acres, not a lot of space for, but when one of the things that's happened is that we've realized that there is great need, and sometimes going to where that need is located and offering our programs can be very successful. So, for example, our Master's in Business Administration program is offered in downtown Minneapolis. We do it at Thrivent. We are in Bloomington at St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, where we are in partnership offering both our Master's of Business and our Master's of Leadership program. We are, as I mentioned, in Rochester, where we are at Bethel Lutheran Church near Mayo, offering both our Master's in Nursing, our Master's in Education, our Master's in Business. This has been ways that we've been able to take a fairly portable program and make it accessible to people in different communities that would otherwise not be able to come to our primary campus, and it's been very successful for us.
Okay, seeing no other questions, we'll move on to Dr. Benninger.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mary Ann Benninger, and I'm president of College of St. Benedict in St. Joseph, Minnesota. As a college president, I appreciate the diversity of higher education, and indeed, many of your questions yielded responses from us that talked about the diversity of our sector. To fulfill its workforce needs and its tax-based needs, the state of Minnesota will need access, retention, and graduation from every sector of higher education. No one type of system or form of education can accomplish this, nor should it. Our own sector, the independent four-year colleges and the institutions with graduate programs in our sector in the Minnesota Private College Council, are diverse in mission in their own right. The diversity is more subtle, perhaps, but never than it is between our institutions and the Minsky system, public higher education in general, but the diversity between our institutions is nevertheless valuable, and it represents the full range of student choices and student opportunities. College of St. Benedict is an institution of 2,100 students. It's located in central Minnesota in Stearns County, was founded in 1913, and therefore we'll be celebrating our 100th anniversary in 2013. College of St. Benedict represents a particular component of the private college sector, the four-year, I would say, classic residential liberal arts college. But I like to use the terms College of Arts and Sciences to describe College of St. Benedict and other institutions that we typically call liberal arts institutions, because I think that we forget that when we talk about the liberal arts, we're really talking about the full range of science and technology as well, what we call STEM disciplines. So all of our institutions, College of St. Benedict included, don't represent only, if you will, the soft side of the arts. They represent the hard side and the technological side of STEM disciplines. While College of St. Benedict enrolls primarily Minnesota students, we also serve the state of Minnesota by attracting high-achieving students from all over the country and indeed all over the world. Many of these students fall in love with Minnesota, graduate in 4 years, I might add, and stay to make a home, raise children, and contribute to the economy of Minnesota. College of St. Benedict also represents the residential college sector. Along with our partner, St. John's University, we have a four-year residency requirement. That is, all of our students are required to live on campus when they're not studying abroad, working on an internship or service project in Stearns County. In the context of this four-year residency, our students form lifelong personal relationships, mentoring relationships with faculty and staff. This form of liberal arts education, in my mind, has two essential characteristics. First, the form of education takes precedence over its contents. That is to say, when a student graduates from College of St. Benedict or St. John's University, regardless of his or her major, she can look forward to any career. With the extraordinary pace of technological and global change, our view is that our students must be prepared to tackle any project, any question, any problem, or any challenge that presents itself. To raise these kinds of graduates, we must focus on the how and the why, not the what. For example, College of St. Benedict has a program called MAP Corps that prepares women for high-tech careers in computer science, mathematics, physics, and pre-engineering. One of the first things that these students do, with absolutely no prior experience whatsoever, is to build robots that compete against each other. They figure out how to do this in teams, on their own, using all the resources that they can find and acquire. And the result is quite astounding when you watch these robots competing against each other. We teach problem-solving, persistence, creativity, and the ability to approach novel situations with confidence. These skills are essential, whether these students become nuclear physicists or high school teachers. But the second characteristic of our kind of liberal arts education is related, but perhaps more important. This kind of education, learning the why and the how, combined with the residential component, where students don't only sit in classrooms with students who are different from them, but where students live with students who are different from them for 4 years. The residential component, I know, seems like a luxury to some, but consider the student of very limited means who gets the opportunity to focus, probably for the first time and perhaps the only time in their life, on their self and their education. That has fundamental life-changing and generation-changing opportunities for that student and that student's family. Some facts and figures about College of St. Benedict. Now, many of you are in Stearns County or past St. Joseph, and you realize that it's a community that in itself is not particularly diverse. And as of yet, we don't have transportation systems that would get someone without a car from College of St. Benedict and St. John's to the cities or to anywhere else for that matter. So our ability to attract a diverse student population can be thought of as somewhat limited. But as you'll see from this slide, over the past 7 years, we have been very single-mindedly focused on increasing the diversity at the College of St. Benedict, and the number of students of color has doubled. And this year, for applications for the academic year 2011-2012, our applications for students of color have again doubled. So even where we are in a suburban/rural community, we're serving these students and serving them well. Our students, as President Privenel mentioned, our liberal arts graduates get jobs, and they certainly do it on par with institutions in the other sector. Even during the recession, graduates from College of St. Benedict were getting jobs at essentially the same rate as they did prior to the recession, and we're noticing an uptick again. Our students leave with 100% of them effectively being placed where they want and need to be placed in graduation, jobs, graduate school, or full-time service. Our students graduate at an extraordinary rate, and I take the representative's point about input yields output. But nevertheless, if you compare College of St. Benedict, and indeed if you can compare the liberal arts institutions, the Minnesota Private College Council institutions, with institutions of our type nationally, that is to say, the students who come to our institutions are equally prepared academically. In Minnesota, we graduate them at a greater rate than they do in other states in the nation. And indeed, at College of St. Benedict, we graduate them at a much greater rate. Our students who do pay very large tuitions, however, are very diverse in their own economic situation. This year, 537 College of St. Benedict students received the state grant, equivalent to 33% of all of our enrolled Minnesota students. The family income of our state grant recipients was $48,000. And the average state grant that our recipients received this year totaled $3,025, which is less than 10% of our tuition and fees and about 7% of the total cost of attendance. So while in one case it's only 10%, it's probably the 10% of their fees that really is the straw that can break the camel's back, or the difference between whether they could attend College of St. Benedict and St. John's University or not. So the state grant program is something that our institution very much appreciates. Our institution is known for its internationalization. We are the institution in the country that sends, the liberal arts college in the country that sends the greatest number of students abroad for a full semester. And right now, in the state of Minnesota, College of St. Benedict and St. John's University are the institution that enrolls the greatest number of international students. First in the state, ninth in the country among liberal arts colleges. We're adapting to changes in the economy. We're adapting to changes in the global environment. And for us, that means putting greater focus on the STEM disciplines. It means putting greater focus on language and international studies. We run our own program in China. 90% of our students study foreign languages, which is off the scale as compared to other institutions. And we teach Asian languages right there in St. Joseph, Minnesota. So here's an example, like the other liberal arts colleges in the state of Minnesota. While in one sense we stick to our knitting and stick to our mission to offer a classic liberal arts and sciences education, we can still do that in a way that's responsive to the needs of the state and the needs of the nation. Thank you very much.
Members, any questions? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am an admitted fan of the institutions that compose the Minnesota Private College Council. That said, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a frequent critic of the sort of debt that students are being saddled with by the time they finish up, and I suspect you share the same concern. My question really is, have you engaged in any kind of ongoing study, either institutionally with your own individual institutions or collectively, about the level of debt that students are, and I appreciate that in your materials, thanks to financial aid, average amount that families actually pay for tuition is $29,506 a year. I'm curious, though, that or I sense that that's probably a significant amount of loans as opposed to just grant-based aid. Is it getting as bad as I sense it's getting? We've got people that can't buy a house, they can't buy a car, they're forbearing their loans longer and longer and longer. Give me some hope, will you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I think I will actually give you hope. I take a different position on this, and I do it with complete respect to our students and their families. They are taking on an extraordinary loan burden, and I think the latest figures that I heard is somewhere in the $22,000 to $23,000 range. College of St. Benedict students are no different than that. I'd like, with due respect to our families, to put that in context, because you mentioned the issue of a car. And one of the things I ask our students repeatedly is, how many cars do you expect to buy and finance in your lifetime? And I don't have national data on this, but typically they'll say to me, oh, maybe three or four, and they start counting their parents' cars. And I ask them, you know, what type of car do you expect to get? Well, surprise, surprise, the loan on the car that they expect to get, I figure, is about the same as the student loan debt that they are burdened with when they graduate from college. And I think it's important to put that debt in that context as a choice. Nationally, when we read about student loan debt, we do hear about the extreme challenge situations. What we don't hear is that the vast majority of students who graduate from any type of institution, whether it's private liberal arts college or a public university, will report that that was one or the best investment that they've ever made. So again, with due respect, I think that the national conversation on loan debt needs to be broadened to fully understand the impact that it has on students' lives. Now, as a college president, I want to be responsible to my students, and I want to provide the very best I can for the dollar that they're spending. So one of the things that I look to is how our students are faring in repaying their loan debt. Because my approach to it to say, well, that might be loan that is valuable, that wouldn't hold up if our students couldn't pay their loans. By and large, our students from the Minnesota private colleges, students from College of St. Benedict, are paying their loans. For years, College of St. Benedict was the institution that had the lowest default rate nationally. It was essentially zero. And through the recession, it has essentially remained the same. So I say that not to belittle in any way. I am still paying student loan debt from my son when he went to college. So I understand this personally, and I don't belittle it. I just think we have to look at what are the cost-benefit factors, and we have to understand that each student's situation is unique.
Just one brief follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
You can decline to answer this if you don't feel qualified to provide an opinion. Do you share the same observation relative to the private for-profit colleges?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll decline to answer that, not because I, not to reflect an opinion, because I really don't have the figures for the for-profit sector. I mean, I know what I read in the news, but perhaps one of the Pauls has them more at hand.
Yeah, they're all. Everybody's leaning away from the microphone.
I think our view has been to let others expound on that situation.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, we have data on our own students, and we'll provide that to you. We don't collect data on the for-profit sector, so we really would not be able to answer with any kind of credibility on that.
And Mr. Chairman, they collect data on you. If you look at their materials, and I suspect, and I appreciate your willingness to share your data, I hope and expect we'll get the same sort of information from the for-profits so that we can reach our own opinions. And I, Madam President, I appreciate your I wouldn't call it refusal, but your reluctance to provide an opinion. I would hope that this committee will be interested, as I am, in seeing the difference between the private for-profits and the non-profits. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We need to move along so we have time for the career profit or career college association. But so go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, if the committee would permit, we'd like to talk just for a minute about the state grant program because it is so important to students at our colleges. I think the place to start to talk about the state grant program is this chart, which shows the relationship on a state-by-state basis between the percentage of a state's population with a four-year degree and the per capita income for each state. As you can see in the chart, there are low education states and high education states. High education states are above the orange line, which is the national average. There are also low income and high income states, and high income states are states to the right of the orange line, which again is the national average for per capita income. Minnesota is a high education, high income state. The key thing, I think, though, to observe about this graph is that for the most part, there are high education, high income states, and there are low education, low income states. With the exception of a couple borderline cases, there are no low education, high income states. It's just probably impossible as an economic strategy to be a low education state and expect to have a high per capita income. And so our challenge is to maintain our relative prosperity by maintaining and improving our educational attainment. Now, to succeed in the coming years, we're going to have to increase the share of our population that earns a post-secondary degree of some chart. The next chart I want you to look at shows...
Can I interrupt you for just a moment? We have a question, I think, on that first
slide. I'm just going to stop you for a second, please, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're not implying there's a causality here, I hope, because the relationship could go in the other direction. It could be simply that high-income states like to spend more money on higher education. So I would wonder if you had a graph on this that would actually indicate the relationship between the growth of income and the number of baccalaureates, rather than just the level. I like the graph, but if you're going to imply a causality here, I'm going to have a little bit of a discussion with you about whether or not that relationship really exists.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we don't have the chart you're asking for, but we'd be glad to sit down and try to look further at the data to find that for you.
I invite you to do that.
Great.
Okay, please continue.
Mr. Chairman, this next chart shows the share of high-ability eighth graders who complete college by family income, and it documents what we've historically known. Students from high- and middle-income families have significantly higher success rates in completing college than students from low-income families. The challenge for Minnesota is that even high-ability students from low-income families have lower success rates in completing college. And as we look to the future in Minnesota, this next chart shows that the number of low-income families or students from low-income families is probably going to be increasing. This is the percentage of students on free and reduced lunch in our schools. And for 10th graders, you see we're at 31%. And you get down to first graders, we're all the way up to 40%. So I think when you put these three charts together, they show why the state grant program is so critical. It's a program that targets scarce public resources at those students who have the highest challenge to succeeding in college. And because the number of those students who have a big challenge in succeeding in college is growing, the state grant program is going to become ever more critical to our educational success. Now, just one last chart, Mr. Chairman. This chart shows the slipping impact of the state grant. As recently as 2006-2007, the state appropriated about $1,952 per state grant recipient. Since that time, that number is falling, so that for 09-10, the most recent school year, the amount appropriated is about $1,635 per grant recipient. And we can expect that when we have the data for the current school year, that number is going to fall again because, as you all know, in the last year there was state grant program deficit and we had to ration the available funds. A number of students lost their grants altogether, and every other student in the system had a reduction in their state grant. There's a real challenge there, and the state grant is a place where you can make it a budget priority and focus the state resources where the need is the greatest. And I know Paul has some data from his own school that he would want to share with you briefly, just so you have an idea of how important even $500 in the state grant is to a student.
Dr. Perbino, if we can wrap it up fairly quick.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Just a quick story. We did some analysis, as you know, with the deficit in the program last year. As Paul has mentioned, the change in the formula. We made a commitment, as did all of our institutions, to try to make up some of that difference in out of our own resources. And so in our case, we knew what was potentially the cost burden for students and their families if they weren't going to receive the state grant program. And of course, it was primarily in that middle income group that was being affected by this. We've looked at our headcount of entering students last year was actually down by about 38 students. And we looked at those 38 students who were kind of in there right to the end, and we looked at their financial aid packages. They were all state grant eligible, but because they were going to receive a lower amount of the state grant program, even with what we were offering to try to make up, we made the decision to try to make up half of that. They made a decision not to attend Augsburg. And we think that there's a direct connection between the fact that, and that might be, as Paul mentioned, as little as $500 or $250, but that had an impact on their ability to make the whole package work. And the power of the state grant program, of course, is it is combined with the Pell Grant, with the family resources, with institutional resources, and it's really the combined effort of these various entities that help to make a college education accessible. And so for us, just again to reiterate what I said at the beginning, this state grant program is fundamental to our commitment to the kind of experience that we've just described here at our institutions, and we appreciate your continued advocacy for it.
Okay, we have one last question from Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just builds on what we just heard. I know, Representative Atkins, you and I are both looking at FAFSA forms and financial aid packages, and I know I talked to the folks at Gustavus yesterday about this. You're trying to put together financial aid packages for students into the coming year. You know that the legislative budgeting process doesn't always work well with your process, but could you just give us a little insight in terms of timing? You're putting together, I assume, packages for students who would be starting college in the fall. How does it affect you if our budget process goes well into your season, well, it starts to approach the summer, and your ability to attract students, keep students in Minnesota, and get students enticed to come to Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, for College of St. Benedict, our need-based financial aid packages are going out generally in early March. And so that's the decision-making time for students in terms of the equation that President Privenow described. And if they can't be sure about how they're going to finance their education, that grant can make a very big difference in their decision-making process. Yes.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cirkvenik, you know, The state grant program has been a very good program, and one of the best, I think, in the country. And but I think, you know, everything's got to be looked at this session. Higher ed already took a hit for the publics here last week and yesterday, and I don't know if the chair is going to be fighting to keep the state grant program whole or not, but what's your opinion on, you know, if we need to get money, where should we get it from as one ranger to another? You know, he put you on the spot, but do you believe in these terrible times that the state can get by with what it has, or can we tax your high salary?
Representative Rukavinas might be putting our three guests on the spot here.
I just want one of them to answer. I'm not picking on the other two. I'm picking on the big wheel here.
You can answer if they want to.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Rukavina, you and I have talked, and you know that I would be happy to take a little increase in my tax level in order to fund the state grant program.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, are you speaking for the head of the private college leadership or just yourself?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we've been asked this question in past years, including last year, and we have always said that additional resources, if invested in education, especially if invested in the state grant program, would have a substantial benefit for the state of Minnesota. And I think our view on that hasn't changed.
I thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And at this time, the Minnesota Career College Association has about 35 minutes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Tom Cosell. I'm the volunteer chair of MCCA, the Minnesota Career College Association. As a volunteer, my full-time job is with Globe University and Minnesota School of Business. And John, you want to meet?
My name is John Blumenthal, and I'm the director of education at Minneapolis Business College, and I serve as our institution's representative on the Minnesota Career College Association.
And Mr. Chair, if I appear physically a little strange, just want to say that it's not that I'm nervous. I share something in common with Michael J. Fox, and sometimes that activity shows itself, so just understand that.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. You should all have this. It's our new brochure updated for this year, and I'd like to walk you through it to kind of give you a picture of who we are. If Representative Atkins was here, I'd like to go right to his question first, but I'll wait till he's back and we can talk about default rates and those things. But if you would take a look at this, at the bottom it says the voice of career college education since 1958. And people always ask us, do we represent all of the career colleges, the for-profits? The answer is no. I took a look at the latest data that's whole, and that's the 2009 fall enrollment. And in that year, there were about 37,000 career college students, excepting for Capella and Walden, which were in a separate category, is all online. And we represent 68% of that, so we're almost 70%. Our members represent about 70% of the students in that sector. So that's the voice we always talk about. There are members, or there are schools that are not members of our group. And so we're speaking for our schools. If you go to the inside cover in the back of this brochure, you'll see our membership. So those are the institutions that are part of the Minnesota Career College Association. And again, that's about 68% of the students. In introducing ourselves, who we are, on page 2 we have our mission and our values. Very simply, the only thing we would ever say in front of this committee is that we ask for access and choice for students, allowing them to choose as Minnesota citizens the kind of institution, the kind of learning environment that fits their needs. And certainly the state grant has been a great blessing. And you're right, I think Representative Rukavina said it is one of the best in the country in terms of fairness and student choice. If you look at who we are, who our students are on the top of page 3, Those are some numbers, again, from the 2009 OHE data. So we're heavily women students. We have a fair group of students of color, and our students are older. They tend to be working. They tend to be married, single parents. Some of the myths that we know surround us, like in the middle of page 3, we're talking about the myth of not having accreditation, and we're accused of that sometimes. All of the members of MCCA are either nationally or regionally accredited, and we have multiple programmatic accreditations that fit the right kind of curriculum. If you take a look on the next page, on page 4, we've got some charts for the state grant from 2009, again, the last year, complete data, to show you where we fit in, the amount our students got, and the average awards are on the bottom of that page, so you can kind of see how we fit into this group. I think I'm going rather quickly because of time, but I think on the top of page 5, you'll see another myth that we've been accused of not preparing students for placement and employment and not having data to back that up. I would say that examples of data, there is some very good data out there. This is an annual study from the ACICS, which is a national accrediting body that Globe and MSB and other schools in our association belong to. In here, they've got a complete review of all placement activities of all members for the year. Percentages, definitions, what's placed, what's in the field, out of the field. And I can get you copies of this if you'd like, but this data is available and it's very interesting to read. This is where I want to get to the question Representative Atkins asked already about default rates. That's on the bottom of page 5. That data came out of the latest year forward default rates is 208. This is the OHE report on that. And so those numbers are from this data. We put that in to show where we stand relative to other schools in the state, because we're often criticized as having a huge difference. If you look at that chart, and then if you get a copy of this report off the OHE site, it shows national versus Minnesota, just to give you totals so we can compare this. And I'd be glad to answer questions about this at this time. The average default rate for the entire country in 08 was 7%. For Minnesota, the average for all students was 3.7, so that's obviously a significant improvement. When you look at the for-profit colleges, nationally they're at 11.6% on average, and in Minnesota 3.9. So we're about a third of the national average. And it's something that you should know. And you asked some questions about that. I'd certainly entertain them at this time if you'd like.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. How do you measure the default rate? I was looking to see where the source data was. Perhaps it's in that additional handout that you have. But the does that include the forbearances and so forth? And if you forbear and continue to do so again and again, and it doesn't show up as a default?
You're right, and that's an issue. And that's going to change, I think, in the future. That's part of the whole idea of how we reduce loan debt and dependency. But right now, forbearance or consolidation, deferments are not in this rate. This is a cohort rate of 2-year period of time. And they're raising it to 3 with the next study. So you'll see a 3-year instead of a 2-year.
And just a
Representative Atkins.
Does anybody have it out 5 years, 10 years? That's where the real action is.
You're right. That's not the way, Mr. Chairman, Representative
Cassell.
That's not the way the DOE does it right now. But I think you're right. That's valid.
And one final question.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, the membership-wise, why aren't Capella and Phoenix?
They are large, and they have their own lobbyists. Representative Atkins, Chair.
Are they, Mr. Chair?
Representative Atkins.
Is their rate the same, about 3.9?
Mr. Cassell.
I do not know, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins. Well, yes, I do. I take that back. And this report from OHE, and I can leave a copy with you, and everybody else is on the OHE site. On the OHE site, all the Minnesota schools are listed for you. And if I can find that page, I'll show you there. And St. Ben's is at 0.0. I'm looking at Capella. They're not listed under the private career colleges. I don't see them under the private.
And
I don't see them right now.
I don't mean to hold things up. I can follow up on that independently, but I was just noted that they weren't members.
Here we found Capella under private graduate schools, 3.3.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Norton.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. relates to this, the same recognition of the data here, because there are students who attend, and I know of some in my district who've attended a for-profit, either were removed from the program for a variety of reasons or moved on to then a two-year public or four-year public college, and I don't know where those, if they do default, where those students show up, because they have actually multiple, they've left one system and gone into another, and how those would be reflected. And I do need to say, one of the complaints that I've had recently is, unfortunately, one of your members, and perhaps I could talk with you after, about the lack of responsiveness as to when a school chooses to remove a student when they've paid $20,000 or $30,000 for a year of tuition and have good grades and are removed from assistance, the lack of responsiveness from those schools to the families of the children that go there. And so maybe offline you and I could discuss that further.
Okay. So go ahead and resume.
All right. Thank you. If you take a look at page 6, just to give you an idea of the history of our schools, we've got 64 years average. You can see John's school started in 1874, ours in 1877, so we've been around a while. I think that you should take some pride in Minnesota in the sense that the career college system in Minnesota is stronger, I think, than nationally. I think it's been because of a very good law that's been in place, and the Department of the OHE has done a good job of enforcing that. I think the responsiveness is important, and that has to be discussed every time it occurs. I think also a couple of the things I'd like to point out. In terms of information on retention, graduation, those things, if you're not familiar with Minnesota Measures, it's an outstanding book. In the back inside cover, you'll find retention comparisons out of this study in page 15, and it shows retention 208-207 comparison of two-year programs. And that's in here. You've got four-year graduation rates, four-year retention rates. So there's a lot of good data out there to take a look at. At this time, I guess I'd like to answer questions. John, do you have anything to add?
The Minnesota...
please identify yourself.
Thank you, Chairman. John Blumenthal, Minneapolis Business College. The career colleges provide another aspect of choice for students, and the career preparation at a small school like mine, which serves two-year college students, we provide professional training in things that include soft skills. We're able to change quickly because we're small. We meet with employers and alumni regularly to keep our programs updated. And we greatly appreciate being a part of the state grant program. We think that the tradition of Minnesota schools in providing the choice to students is paramount, and that's our primary message today.
Mr. Chair, and Tom Cosell, I think also that when you look at the data for state grant, sometimes I think people feel may get too big a share, our students may, but if you look at the numbers again for 209 year, and I can provide you with this, the Minnesota state grant, the dollars we got was 13.4% of all the dollars that year. Our number of students was 13.8% of all the students. So, you know, not quite a one-to-one, but pretty close to where it should be. So it's not an overreach, I don't think.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The president of St. Ben's talked about their average debt load between, upon completion of a four-year degree, somewhere between $22,000 and $23,000. Do you have that figure?
Mr. Purcell? I can provide it for you very clearly, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins. We're a group of institutions, but we're all independent businesses. So we don't always share the information because we're friendly competitors.
Yeah.
But I will certainly get that for you as best I can.
And then the only, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Purcell, the additional piece would be you seem to have a lot of comparative data relative to Minnesota's nonprofit private institutions as well as the University of Minnesota and Minsky institutions. Can you provide a comparison for what your students earn upon completion of their four-year degree relative to those other example institutions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I will get that for you also.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do your career colleges utilize like advisory boards of individual portions or career paths to keep you up to date on what's necessary for jobs today?
Mr. Chairman, we have program advisory committees for every curriculum program. Those are employers in industry. They meet twice a year. They review curriculum. They look at placement. They look at salaries. Look at technology. They give advice, and then we help implement that. So it's an annual, twice a year review. That's part of the accrediting requirements. I think also, Mr. Chair, to add to that, we talked about, Representative Norton talked about students coming from different schools having debt packages. It goes both ways. We have many students who have come to us from other systems where, for whatever reason, it didn't work for them, and now this one is working. So that whole packaging and the default rate and the loan backup is serious, and I think it has to be addressed, but it has to be addressed by counseling and advice. I think the ideas of forbearance, deferment, consolidation have to be looked at, and the discussion should really be paying principal, reducing interest, and keeping the loan debt down. And that's something we have to teach our young people.
I was just going to make an observation. This morning, the Public Service Public Safety Committee went over to the BCA office and had a tour. That is pretty impressive over there, pretty high-tech, high-skilled individuals. And I asked when we were at the DNA station, we went, you know, from place to place, but where they were doing the DNA testing, and I asked where they get their education. And a lot of them actually are trained on the job, but they come in with a certain set of basic training, but specifically for the job they were doing, they were actually trained right there at the site. So I think that's what happens today is where you, whether you go to a career college or wherever you are, you get your basic met as far as the education level met, and then from there the career often either starts or it takes a different path. You don't know. So it was just an observation to go through a place that had some very sophisticated employees doing some really work that was exact. You don't want to make any mistakes.
And Mr. Chair, we would invite any members of the committee to visit a campus of any of our schools. Some of you have them in your district, some do not. They're nearby, but I'd love to show you what we do. Love to have you sit through an admissions presentation and see the integrity with which we talk to students and families. So you're more than welcome anytime.
Thank you very much. We may take you up on that.
Good.
Any members have any other last questions? If not, we thank you for
thank
your
you.
Presentation.
Okay, yeah, I don't have a Norton. Question, so if you wanted to excuse me, I did have just a comment for the chair. I could do that.
Okay, we'll let them. They don't have to hear this.
Well, no, it's for the body. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
This morning, the K-12 Policy Committee had some testimony from the University of Minnesota and the Board of Teaching, and I thought it very appropriate to what we're dealing with on this committee, and particularly with some of the questions that have come up. My colleague from the Rochester area, Mr. Benson, has raised some questions with regard to the need for remediation. And actually, there's some very proactive work being done looking down the road through the Department of Education on teacher preparedness. And I think it would perhaps be interesting for this committee, and I've asked their legislative liaison to have a talk with you and the committees, but I do think with the questions that come up here, it's a K-12 issue, the training is done at the universities and colleges across the state of Minnesota, and so it might be good for us to hear about that at some point. As I listened to it this morning, I thought it was very appropriate for higher ed, so I just thought I'd mention that.
Sure. Thank you very much for that suggestion. Any other questions, comments? If not, we are adjourned until Thursday.